This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, Thursday, the 14th of March. Here is what Tom, Richard and myself have been focusing on this morning. Well, we've been looking at the business end of Ramadan, asking the question, what does it mean for food delivery? A man who came in with a number of numbers to illustrate his points, which quite frankly is behaviour that we encourage amongst our desks, so he is our favourite today, is Jess Karen Singh, the Vice President of Food from Careem. We have also been speaking to a man about a law. Jacques Visser is the Chief Legal Officer of DIFC Authority. They've just passed a landmark new digital assets law. Jacques's been putting it in context for us, as indeed has the Emirates MBD economist Dan Richards. We've also seen, speaking of legalities, we've also seen the House of Representatives in the US passing what effectively is a ban on TikTok in the US if its Chinese owner don't sell it. We've been looking at that and how to control chatbots during elections with Professor Nancy Gleason of New York University, Abu Dhabi. One of our top stories, the DIFC bringing in or enacting a new law covering digital assets. And Rich, you've been speaking to the lawyer in charge.
Yeah, Chief Legal Officer, DIFC Authority is Jacques Visser. We asked him very simply, why have you done this?
A lot of attention is being given, I think quite rightly so, in regulating the front end of one component of digital assets, which is cryptocurrency. So we've seen a lot of regulation dealing with concerns around cryptocurrency, whether it's in relation to money laundering, whether it's in relation to consumer protection. Very little thought has been given to the sort of the foundational legal concepts behind what constitutes a digital asset. And a digital asset is obviously far more than just cryptocurrency. And a digital asset is one of the biggest developments and biggest asset classes that we see, you know, for the future, also for a place like the DIFC.
We get some reaction to this from Dan Richards, Emirates MBD. Okay, for DIFC, they're a finance hub. I get why they'd be looking at digital assets. But what does it mean for the broader economy? So, for example, DIFC has enacted these new laws. What does it mean for Dubai?
These new regulations will provide clarity, security and confidence for businesses and investors in Dubai involved with a rapidly growing sector of digital finance. Now, this is already a $1 trillion industry and is expected to continue growing rapidly as elements such as blockchain are more widely adopted and fully integrated into existing financial systems. This new legislation will make Dubai and DIFC ever more attractive to the industry, and it's the latest of a series of innovations aimed at capturing the growth market, including the previous establishment of VARA, the Digital Asset Regulatory Authority, which was set up to cater for firms operating outside of the DIFC.
Yeah, that was one of two fairly important finance stories yesterday. Perhaps not very exciting, but important. New laws for digital assets in DIFC and Moody's, the ratings agency, changing its outlook on UAE banks. It was stable, so it was already pretty good, but they've increased it to positive. The guys at Moody's cited strong capital buffers, which will inch higher on the back of bottom line profitability for the banks. Again, to Daniel, what's the bigger picture impact of this?
Ratings agency Moody's has raised its outlook on UAE banks to positive from stable previously, citing the robust economic growth the country is enjoying alongside a positive net interest margin environment, as rate cuts are not expected to come until the second half of the year. We would agree with the agency's broad argument, given that we forecast real GDP growth of 4.5% in the non-oil economy this year, and we have long held a view that the Federal Reserve will not start cutting rates until June at the earliest, and that the pace of cuts thereafter will be gentle.
Dan Richards, Emirates MBD.
One of our other big stories this morning is that landmark bill being passed by the US House of Representatives before it heads to the Senate that could see TikTok banned in America if the owners don't sell it. Tom, who have you been speaking to?
Yeah, in fact, we had Nancy Gleason join us a little earlier on from NYU Abu Dhabi, the Sadiat campus there. She's the Associate Professor of Practice and Political Science down there. In fact, we got her under false pretenses, as it were, because she was on to talk about the latest Google move to limit the amount of electoral or political questions you can put to their Gemini system, which is ChatGPT competitor for Google. So we got on to talk about that. That moved on to the breaking news overnight, as you said, about TikTok potential ban over in America and the decision by the US House of Representatives. But both of those together sort of added towards the question, are the big tech companies out there currently flexing their potential, what do we call it, their swaying outcome muscles, if you like, at the moment in light of a number of elections this year?
Absolutely. And the regulatory environment of each country makes this very interesting how these platforms operate. So European Union passed the AI Act yesterday as well. So it's a very busy time for compliance and regulatory environments. These platforms are being used as manipulation tools of the public. And that's no different than any other form of media in the past. It's the scale, it's the accessibility, it's the fact that it's typically free of cost. It operates across languages, across countries, across time, that makes this more concerning for the outcome of elections and the veracity of democracies. So we have work to do in educating the public about these tools. The trust has to come with verification. We should never rely on them alone.
Nancy Gleason, New York University, Abu Dhabi.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Where we are looking this morning at what Ramadan means for the food delivery business. Joined by one of the largest. Jaskaran Singh is Vice President of Food at Careem. Jaskaran, it's lovely to meet you. Good morning.
Morning, Brandy. Morning, everyone. Pleasure to be here.
So what happens to your business during Ramadan? How much busier do you get?
Yeah, great question. Ramadan is a special time, as we all know. So the demand pattern shifts a bit. We have like three broad groups of people who fast religiously and throughout, and then people who don't fast all the time. And then there's a crossover group, which is not really fasting, but it's quite interested in the culture and the tradition. So typically we see the peaks shift a bit. Typically on a regular day outside of Ramadan, lunch and dinner are the big peaks. As you would imagine, iftar and suhoor also become quite critical. And I can cover more there wherever there's more interest.
Yeah. So let's start with the actual demand itself. Yes. Are you actually busier overall?
Yes. So the first week is a bit slower, but then as we go into weeks 2, 3, and 4, we actually get busier overall.
Why do you think that is?
So I think two things happen. One is obviously for folks who are fasting, Ramadan, iftar and suhoor become moments when they engage. And then for the people who are not fasting, but like are culturally interested in some of those things, they also start to order during iftar and suhoor.
So if you were to put a really rough percentage number on how much busier you are during Ramadan, what would that number look like?
So I think by the middle of the month, about 10% higher. And then towards the last week, it could go up to 15 to 20%.
Okay. So how do you deal with that in terms of the way you schedule drivers or even how many you use?
Yeah, great question. Obviously, the supply has to mirror the demand. And so we do two things. One is we try and have a higher mix of non-fasting captains. And the second is during the peak times, which is iftar and suhoor, we try and oversupply. And that's how we manage supply and demand. Another interesting factoid, this year, interestingly, people are ordering iftar about half an hour earlier, because they want to make sure that they get their food on time. And that also helps us.
I got stuck in traffic the other day at 3 o'clock, was obviously when a lot of companies were kicking out. People were going home. Is it actually taking you longer to make deliveries for the guys on bikes?
We haven't seen a major increase in delivery times. Now, of course, when the weather is inclement, then that becomes quite problematic. But overall, no.
And how are you looking after your riders who are fasting themselves?
Yeah. Great question. So I think we do two things. One is we set the right customer expectations during these times. So you might see that your food will take a little bit longer to arrive. And the second is we increase the overall supply, which allows our captains enough time to break their fast and pray.
So let's look at what's actually being ordered. Are you seeing a shift in what restaurants are the busiest and what people want?
Yeah, interestingly, that does happen. So fast food is no longer as famous. The top cuisines we're seeing so far is Levant and Arabic, number one, as you would expect. And then a lot of the desi food, so Indian and Pakistani as well. So those are the top two cuisines. We're also seeing many more sweets being ordered. So dessert orders are up by about 50%.
What about the basket size?
Yeah, great question. So we've seen average basket size goes up by about 20 to 25%. People also add more items to basket. And people are also trying to make more orders in groups, for which we have campaigns. We have a feature called group ordering. Our marketplace kicks in, and we have multiple captains dispatch for large orders wherever we need to.
I was going to say, I mean, the box on the back of the bike is specified by law as to the size that it can be. How do you cope with the bigger orders? What do you do? Have you got a cap on an order size?
No, so we actually we accept pretty large orders during Ramadan. You know, with all the data that we have on like number of items, volumes, basket sizes, we have algorithms and AI models which kick in, which tell us that you might need more than one captain, and then we might get in touch with the restaurant and then send more people as needed.
And how are the restaurant's own hours changing?
The restaurant's own
hours, the hours of operation. Are you seeing shifts in your partners as to when they're open, when they're delivering?
Yeah, so we're delivering 24/7, and naturally the partners are operating. But again, they're being quite diligent with their operations during iftar and suhoor, but they're operating 24/7.
Okay. Well, I know whenever I open up any of the apps, there's a lot of new offers, a lot of new specials going on at the moment. You've tied up with Dubai Tourism to do something. What's that?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So we've launched this new service called Dine Out. And in partnership with Dubai Tourism, customers can now pre-book iftars at 200-plus venues with amazing discounts. So this includes like your traditional tents, so like the Layali tent, the terrace between the towers, as well as some of your more popular venues like June's, Reef Kushiyaki, and so on and so forth. And it's been like 2 days since we've launched this product, and it's flying off the shelves.
What does flying off the shelves look like? Give me some numbers.
Well, the first day of launch, within a couple of hours, we had 200 bookings for a new product. That's pretty exciting.
You've also got the Eat a Plate to Fill a Plate initiative.
Yeah.
Talk to me about how we're thinking of others whilst ordering our own.
Yeah, so this is the third year we are running Eat a Plate to Fill a Plate. This is in partnership with Emirates Red Crescent and about 700 restaurants. So for every meal you order, there's 2 dirhams which gets donated, and then Emirates Red Crescent uses those funds.
How many people are actually doing that, though?
The numbers are pretty large. This year, for context, we are targeting 500,000 dirhams, so 500,000, between this campaign as well as Right Click, which is a new donations feature we've launched, especially in support for Gaza and other causes.
Do we see the tips for drivers in general going up during Ramadan? Are we more mindful?
Yes. So tips for captains do go up about 20% during Ramadan. That's another thing we see. Now we're trying to improve the way we allow customers to tip. So there's some more way we need to go there. But customers are definitely more empathetic during this time.
How might you improve that way? What are you considering?
Well, today we only allow customers to add a tip while placing an order. Many people might want to tip after finishing the order. We don't have that right now, but we're working hard on it. We'll bring it to you soon.
Let's look at where you are in terms of the rise of users in general, if we can maybe use you as a bit of proxy data for what's happening to the population here. What kind of percentage increase did you see in 2023?
Yeah, so I'll answer it at two levels. So one is, of course, given Kareem is an everything app, so we've seen users on the platform go up by about 20%. Now, you'll recall that we entered food delivery later. So for food delivery for us has grown like 80% last year, which is pretty exciting.
And are you seeing demographic shifts being reflected in terms of what people are ordering and the restaurants that are on there?
Yeah, so two kinds of shifts to call out. Us operating ride-hailing, naturally we have a lot of tourists on the platform, so about 20% are tourists. And this figure stays consistent through the year. I guess Dubai is an attractive place for different reasons throughout the year. So that's one shift I'd like to call out. In terms of restaurants, the number of restaurants has gone up. People are starting to look at, they're quite particular about what they want, so they're starting to be quite interested in healthy and more choices on the kind of food.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Particularly love a guest who comes in with numbers to share. Jashkaran Singh is Vice President of Food at Careem, talking to us this morning about Ramadan and what it means for their food delivery patterns and the way that they look after their riders. Thank you very much for your time this
morning. Thanks for having me.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
The aforementioned big legal boss is Jacques Visser. To give him his formal job title, Chief Legal Officer at the DIFC Authority, with us in the studio. Morning, Jack.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
So it's our top story this morning. Most of Dubai's business media leading with this one. You've enacted a new law on digital assets. In simple terms, what is this? And more importantly, why have you done it?
Well, let's start with the why component first. I think a lot of attention is being given, I think quite rightly so, in regulating the front end of one component of digital assets, which is cryptocurrency. So we've seen a lot of regulation dealing with concerns around cryptocurrency, whether it's in relation to money laundering, whether it's in relation to consumer protection, marketing and promotion thereof, etc. But very little thought has been given to the sort of the foundational legal concepts behind what constitutes a digital asset. And a digital asset is obviously far more than just cryptocurrency. And a digital asset in sort of a future digital economy and the future of finance is one of the biggest developments and biggest asset classes that we see, you know, for the future, also for a place like the DIFC. So it was important for somebody to come out and make a statement in this regard. This is a global first. It's not been done elsewhere. And if you look what has happened elsewhere, from the UK, you had a set of recommendations coming out of the Law Commission. And from other organizations, international organizations, you had statements of principle and very much also diverging, sort of core decisions on some of the key concepts in property law about what is a digital asset. So it was important for us to come out and make a statement as DIFC, because we see so much growth in this particular area. We now have close to 1,000 fintech and innovation companies, and we're obviously housing sort of some of the biggest, 27 out of 29 of sort of the systemically important global banks. So it was important for us to come out and make a statement as to, create legal certainty. And I think that's the why component.
Okay, so let's understand what we're talking about here. In the release, it's described as a $1 trillion asset class, although you pointed out to me earlier, Bitcoin alone has a market value of over $1 trillion right now, so it's much bigger than that. If this was a pie chart and we were looking at digital assets, how much of that pie chart would be cryptocurrencies? How much would be NFTs, Bored Ape, and things that we know? And how much of it would be slightly more boring but important things like letters of credit on the blockchain and stuff like that?
Well, I don't have the exact statistics, but I know that September of last year, and obviously we had a massive value increase, especially on the crypto side since then. But in September of last year, the market value of crypto was in the region of between 1.3 to 1.5 trillion. So if you factor that in, that is probably now in the region of about $2 trillion. I would say that the overall market of digital assets is currently in the region of about $3 trillion. So you would say crypto makes up about two-thirds at present. But the other sides will increase.
That will increase?
Yes.
And we're not talking about Bored Ape NFTs. We're talking about the plumbing of finance. And you mentioned that in your release, don't you? That it's things like trade finance, stuff that happens behind the scenes,
yes,
migrating to the blockchain. Briefly, and we've only got a few minutes, how does that work and why does it matter?
Well, it matters, the law, why the law in this context matters firstly is that we bring legal certainty on the foundational concept. So that from a economic growth perspective in order to sort of facilitate growth and facilitate sort of mining the value out of the asset class is quite important. But if you look at the digital economy and if you look at the future of finance, and especially in the context where you will have less and less intermediation of what we see now of conventional finance and things moving more on a peer-to-peer basis and on a sort of a systems-operated basis where digital value is sort of the currency of exchange. I think in that context, that will grow far bigger, and it will expand into areas that that we don't even think about now. And a very good example is issues around privacy. Data is the new oil. And at present, we all easily give away our personal data and consent to that being used and being utilized in generation of trend analysis and targeting you from a commercial perspective. But at some point, you may want to even monetize that. And so your own value in all of the data and how you use it on the internet becomes itself a tool of value creation. And that can be part of the digital economy.
How do you play nicely with other regulators? People sitting at home watching this in the office or driving to work listening to it will be thinking, hang on, we've already got VARA, the Virtual Assets Regulatory Authority in Dubai. They're about a kilometre away from you. They're down in the trade centre. You've got ADGM as well in Abu Dhabi. That's where Binance is based. And that's before we get to onto any kind of federal regulation as well.
Correct. And I think there's obviously a number of historical reasons why we have somewhat of a fractured sort of regulatory landscape. And there's a lot of effort going on behind the scenes to harmonize that and get to a point that it's sort of not that confusing. But, you know, we all have a role to play. And if you use VARA as an example and how that, say, interacts with DIFC, VARA, if you saw the growth of the crypto business in Dubai over say, the last 4 or 5 years, just, you know, the plethora of businesses that came up, somebody had to step in from an onshore Dubai-based perspective and say, we need to control this from a reputational perspective. And that's where VARA stepped in. Now, VARA is an onshore regulator. It basically sits under the remit of ESCA from a financial services, the Emirates Securities and Commodities Authority.
10 seconds left, final thoughts.
But there's room for all of us, and we work together a lot in making it easier for industry.
Jack, I'm sure this isn't the final time we'll have this conversation. Appreciate you coming in this morning. We will explore it in more detail in the weeks and months ahead. But for now, our thanks to the Chief Legal Officer of DIFC Authority on what is a very busy morning for you, Jack Vissas.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Busy old year for elections for us. It's been confirmed, well, almost confirmed and rubber stamped, that President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump have secured the delegates necessary to clinch their party's presidential nominations. That's according to AP, cementing a general election rematch later on this year. And it's going to be an election like no other. Trump versus Biden again, the first US election rematch in 68 years. A lot of analysts suggesting it's going to be the longest election campaign like ever. A lot of analysts suggesting it's going to be the most expensive like ever as well. Also, it could be one of the most controversial, hence why a number of the major companies over in the United States have started to make some interesting noises with regards to the election. Google, in recent days, confirming it's restricting the types of election-related questions users can ask its artificial intelligence chatbot, Gemini. Why are they doing this? Anything to do with the impending election in the States and elsewhere? Let's find out now from the Professor of Practice of Political Science at the NYU Abu Dhabi Sadiat campus, and also the Director of the Hilary Ballon Centre for Teaching and Learning, Nancy W. Gleason, joining us live on the line. Nancy, thanks for your time this morning.
Pleasure to join you again. Good morning.
Let's get some insight on this. Your thinkings of why the concerns about chatbots impacting electoral integrity, could they?
They absolutely can. This is a legitimate concern. And what happened this week is that Gemini, which is Google's version of ChatGPT, if you will, announced that they will manipulate the model so that it can not answer specific questions on election-related queries. So they're restricting the types of answers the model can give to try to prevent misinformation coming out of the model.
And the concerns of misinformation is something that has dogged a number of election campaigns in the past. Are we moving into interesting times, rather choppy waters, when it comes to that misinformation and just the wealth of it available out there?
We absolutely are. So election year 2024 is the biggest ever in human history. We have 49% of people on the globe voting this year in 64 different countries, plus the European Union. So the danger of manipulation isn't just coming from large language models like ChatGPT or Gemini. It's all forms of media. But the difference is we don't know where the ideas come from when they come from a large language model like ChatGPT. What they're trying to prevent is deliberate misinformation campaigns, which were waged in the 2016 elections in the UK and the United States by Cambridge Analytica and other organizations that deliberately sent misinformation or doubled down on extreme views through social media platforms. So they're trying to elevate authoritative information and prevent the spread of misinformation.
There's always been a question mark around the most recent election campaigns over in the United States. Will that be part of the campaigns moving forward for former President Trump and others? And again, because of the sort of rise in chatbots and AI and its influence therein, is this a big concern for the electioneers of how they get their policies right moving forward?
Absolutely. Part of this is about getting voters' attention in all of these countries. In April, we'll have India's massive election, and that this is the context within which Gemini's announcement came this week. And the concern is that while trying to capture voters' attentions, these large language models could incite violence, spread hate speech beyond just misinformation. So we need to ensure that people develop the information literacy to manage these platforms. But in the interim time, it's the obligation of the governments that run these elections to work with industry and the social media platforms, as well as the large language model chatbots, to ensure that misinformation isn't spread at scale and quickly.
Interesting you mentioned there, yeah, about the fact that it's being rolled out in India first. I mean, obviously, calendar-wise, it's the first of the major elections, if you like, starting in April. But will that be something of a testing ground ahead of elections South Africa, the UK, the US later on in the year?
Absolutely. And so we're starting to see very public announcements of things like digital watermarking, so that you have to know if it's a deep fake that is making a speech or not. You have to have industry collaboration so that you can have coalitions on standards in different countries. And these are all things that are being tried in India, which will be the first of the most large-scale elections in terms of numbers of voters and potential for the spread of misinformation that could sincerely affect the outcome. So yes, India is a testing ground for platforms like Gemini, ChatGPT, and others. As we leave the world of prompt engineering, right? The what I write the AI and ask it to give me back. And we enter a world where platforms like Gemini transform your prompt into what it thinks you want the answer to be. Mm. We have to be very careful about how we use these platforms to get our information and inform our political views.
Nancy, no shortage of challenges therein. Are there opportunities as well?
Absolutely. I think we can't move forward without these platforms playing a leadership role. They can offer transparency on election advertisements, something you might not have in the print form. This goes across platforms, so it includes things like YouTube, where you might see videos of candidates or people who support them. It can put content labels on all of their platforms, and it has community guidelines for engagement on their platforms. I'm thinking specifically of Google here, but OpenAI has this as well. And political content policies. All of these organizations need to have this and then implement them consistently across countries. And I think this is a place where we really need these organizations and these industry leaders like Google to be out in front, telling others how this can be done and being very open with the public about what they are doing to help inform authoritative voices. Things like where are the voting centers can be pushed to the top. And that's very helpful, rather than having to dig for that information in these massive information centers.
So we do have 1 minute remaining, but we live in very interesting times, as you said, biggest election year that we have had in recent history. Google with their announcement overnight. And then, of course, within the last 24 hours, US House of Representatives passing that landmark bill that could see TikTok banned in America. Are we seeing the big tech companies really flex their potential swaying outcome muscles at the moment?
Absolutely. And the regulatory environment of each country makes this very interesting how these platforms operate. So European Union passed the AI Act yesterday as well. So it's a very busy time for compliance and regulatory environments. These platforms are being used as manipulation tools of the public. And that's no different than any other form of media in the past. It's the scale, it's the accessibility, it's the fact that it's typically free of cost. It operates across languages, across countries, across time, that makes this more concerning for the outcome of elections and the veracity of democracies. So we have work to do in educating the public about these tools. The trust has to come with verification.
Yeah.
We should never rely on them alone.
Nancy, we're going to leave it there. Big thanks to you for joining us to give us a little more insight on that one. Professor of Practice of Political Science, Director of the Hilary Ballant Centre for Teaching and Learning, Nancy Gleeson.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a DubaiEye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from DubaiEye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.